Hi, this is Michael Creamer, and welcome to the next in my Spotlight series on corporate real estate with a focus on the flexible work environment. It's my pleasure to have two people in the studio with me today, both experts in this field. Firstly, Toby Ogden from The Office Group. Welcome, Toby.
Thank you.
And Emma Swinnerton, who works at Cushman & Wakefield.
Thank you.
I thought maybe we'd just start, as I usually do, with a little bit of background. And Toby, doing my research for this, I noticed that you did political science at university. So is there a story in how you got from that into property?
Probably not a very interesting one.
It's always interesting with you.
I, like most people, I kind of was looking around at what I was interested in, what seemed relevant to the world at the time. And so while at school, chose political science, did it for 3 years, enjoyed it, found it a bit theoretical and was sort of reaching for something tangible, something you can pick up, look at, touch and feel. And my dad had been in real estate, albeit in an entirely different part of the field than I am. And I think it was probably the trips to estate agents and every holiday we'd ever been on that kind of made me realize that I liked buildings. And so after I completed political science and the search for something tangible, I ended up moving into real estate. And 13 years later, that's where I am.
Cool. And Emma, natural sciences, that's even probably as far afield from property as political science.
I came here via a bit of a roundabout route. So did a science degree at university, and similar to Toby, although that was very tangible, I realised that I didn't really want to be a full-time scientist. So looked at lots of different options when I was leaving and actually joined the British Airways graduate training scheme, which gave me a really good grounding in business. So essentially I had a first career in the travel and aviation space. And then was later recruited for a role at IWG, which I thought was really interesting because it gave me an insight into a totally different sector and was also a good career move for me. And so that was my kind of first step into property. And the timing was perfect because it was almost just at the start of the flexible workspace evolution. So it was a classic place of right place, right time for me to build the experience that I'm now leveraging in this role.
Great. And anyone listening who thinks a real estate degree isn't worth doing, I did one and I still managed to have a career. So you don't need
I did one as well. I just did it second. Just didn't get it right the first time.
Yeah. So when I started, we were talking about this earlier, Emma, but when I started work, I don't think flexible office was a concept or a term. And we were talking about, I guess, the best known group, Regus, which started in 1989. And you were telling us about the genesis of the idea that Mark Dixon had. Do you maybe want to tell that story?
Sure. Well, Mark is a classic entrepreneur. I think he had a number of catering businesses initially. So he started life selling burgers and building out his business across a number of burger vans. And then he subsequently moved to Belgium and was running an apartment rental business when the story has it that he was in a cafe and used to see a number of people coming and going from the cafe, but using it as a place to work. And so he recognized that there was an opportunity to actually build temporary workspaces or short-term workspaces for people to those kind of markets go and leverage. And that was really the start of Regus, which is now the biggest flexible workspace business globally.
Yeah. And Toby, it's obviously, as an industry, it's changed a lot. So maybe before we get into it, into the changes that we've seen, you could maybe try and describe when we say flexible working. There's co-working, there's flexible working, there's flexible service working. What is it? Do you want to see if you can define it for us or talk a little bit about what it is?
I think even in trying to ask the question, you realize that there's a lot of confusion around what exactly the sector is. And I think that there's the term co-working has been adopted as kind of an umbrella term. But what we're really talking about is the provision of space for people to use, whether they're individuals or small businesses or project teams for bigger businesses, or indeed, as we're starting to see, entire businesses themselves come into to an operator or a provider who then will create that space for them, build it, design it, operate it, so run it and service it, clean it, keep it secure, activate it by events and education and health and fitness, and do that on a very flexible basis. And the measure of flexibility is about how long does that business or that individual have to commit to that operator in terms of the period of time they're going to be there. And the traditional market, I think, has to be looked at as the counterpoint to understand why it's called flexible. So in the traditional market, you would go to a landlord. The landlord would invest in building a building. They would create that building largely to what in the UK you would call a category A condition. So for those of you who don't know, it's basically there'd be some floors, there might be some carpet, there would be walls that are the structural walls and the windows, but there would be no rooms that you could define. You could see as there's no desks, there's no decoration, it's largely a white box. And a landlord would expect you and your business to come along and commit to that and take a lease on that space for a period of time that would generally be between 5 to 20 years. And that is largely viewed by a lot of customers as inflexible because it doesn't match to what they or their employees need. And so the flexible workspace business was effectively a solution to solve the problem for businesses or people who wanted space, which was built for them, but they could kind of choose to take it for much shorter periods that kind of matched their own business objectives rather than necessarily a period of time that was potentially outside the realms of their own vision for what their business was going to be, how long they could be for, be in it for.
So this was, and if we to talk about Regis, but this was an individual who came up with a business idea that was disrupting, particularly in the UK, and obviously he went global, but disrupting the real estate, traditional real estate industry in terms of lease length. And having a focus on what businesses need first and foremost, rather than what he might need as a, and he wasn't a landlord, so he was taking space. So Emma, maybe you could talk that about that a little bit, because in this story, the server, the flexible office space sits between the tenant and the landlord. And so that came about, as Toby said, because of the lease, the lack of flexibility in leases. Was there anything else going on in terms of the space that was being offered that those tenants weren't getting from a traditional landlord?
Well, I think it's interesting from a tenant perspective. There's a taking or leasing property, as Toby's just described, is actually quite complicated. So you need to hire a lawyer to understand a 40-page lease document. You need to recruit an IT company to put in your internet cables, and it can take 3 months to get those installed. You need to hire a fit-out contractor to actually design and build your space. You need to install coffee machines and get somebody to put milk in the fridge and have somebody to sit on the reception desk and somebody to fix the light bulbs when they're broken and somebody to clean the space. It's quite difficult, and that's actually a distraction from your core business. So what the operators, the flexible workspace operators, are doing is providing all of these services to that end customer to make it easy for them to take space. So as well as the flexibility, it's the ease of taking that space, which is really responding to what occupiers need in a way that wasn't evident before this industry arose.
And through all of this, the landlords have, until quite recently, I'd be right in saying, I think, sort of sat on the sidelines a little bit. And maybe we'll come back to that in a bit, because I think we need to talk about that sort of massive disruption that happened a few years ago as well. But so we've got one or two serviced offices. So if we take the 2000s, are there a number of people getting into this space, or was it one or two big companies doing this?
So if you look at where the market is now, there are probably 2 to 3 truly global operators, which is IWG, WeWork, and then the third operator is an Australian company called Servcore, who are significantly smaller than the other two. Then in the UK, because it's quite a mature market, there are a number of medium-sized operators with maybe 30 to 60 locations, quite mature businesses. They've been around for a number of years. The Office Group is a great example of that. Outside of those operators, there's then a huge long tail of smaller and independent operators. So it's a classic case of 80-20, where the, you know, the biggest operators make up less than 20% of the market. And there's huge diversity in terms of that tail of operators, in terms of how those businesses are trying to differentiate their offer, be that on location, price, design, how they're actually appealing to potentially different industry types or even different demographics of people.
Okay, maybe I'd like to come back to that a little later on, because I do think there's presumably something's going to happen in the next few years around all those different operators. Just before we do, Toby, what if we touch on the market, at least from my point of view, it's been, it seemed to me that the when it started, it appealed mainly to startups and to smaller businesses. And it was very rare that we'd be acting for an occupier client who wanted 10, 20,000 square feet or more, who would be that interested in going into a space unless they needed swing space, unless it was for a very short period of time. That has definitely shifted in the last few years. Occupiers are beginning to look at this space in a different way. So why is that? What's happened to the occupier that they now consider this market as integral to their whole portfolio?
So I think it's a really interesting convergence of two big themes, I think. So the industry, the serviced or flexible office industry, historically made its sort of USP was around flexibility. It wasn't about the space per se. It was about the fact that you could take it. It would be fitted, so it was easy, but it was generally kind of generic, and design wasn't at the forefront of what of kind of the way that an operator set itself out. It was competing with the traditional landlord on flexibility. It could give you flexibility, therefore you would go for it, and that's why it appealed to smaller businesses. And sort of swing space for businesses, because the flexibility is what they were looking to buy. Over time, as the business and the industry has developed, the level of competition has increased, and it's become about more than that. So Emma talked about the long tail and about people trying to effectively differentiate their offer as more and more competitors enter the market. And what people have done is they've tried to compete in different ways. So the business that I work for was started in 2003 by two guys who wanted to fundamentally redefine the office market and the provision of space and focus it entirely around creating beautiful design-led spaces that people wanted to put their businesses into. It wasn't about their brand. It was about creating the best home for someone to put their business into. Every building was different. And design is kind of at the forefront of what we do and what they did. So you have that sort of conversion of people really realizing they needed to compete and they needed to offer more than flexibility. At the same time, from a corporate real estate perspective, and I think you can probably give a view on this as well, real estate as a function has shifted from being something that was a cost to a business to, you know, it was just like, how do you reduce the cost of real estate? It's now shifted to being something that can drive value. And if you can get the best workspaces, whether it's through a flexible provider or you provide it yourself, it has a material impact on your ability to recruit people, to retain people, and to create the best working environment, which enhances ultimately the output of that business itself. What's happened is, as that demand for people wanting beautifully created and designed and thoughtfully designed spaces has increased, and the flexible workplace sector has realized they need to compete on more than flexibility, there's been a convergence. And what they've realized is that people like my business, which spends a lot of almost every waking hour thinking about how do you design the best workplace, has become increasingly appealing to those businesses that want to provide the best workplace. So there's been a convergence that's brought kind of the demand to attract and retain the best talent to providers who are really thinking about design and the best workplace. Add to that flexibility, you have a really compelling business case for businesses to effectively outsource to best-in-class providers to provide the best space.
And I think when we were talking about this earlier, and we can't have this conversation, Emma, without talking about WeWork, who came onto the scene guessing 7 years ago, more or less.
I think it was about 10 years. 10, yeah.
Who really have disrupted the industry, I think we'd all agree, in a very positive way. Can you just add to what Toby's been saying? What did they bring that helped shift these larger corporates into taking this type of space? Because I think they had a lot to do with that.
Yeah, I mean, I think WeWork can be described as a catalyst for change, as you said, not just in the flexible workspace part of the industry, right, but more generally. I think a couple of things that they did differently is, firstly, with regard to their brand. As Toby described, some of the operators who'd been around for a little while either had quite kind of transparent brands or brands that kind of sat in the background because they wanted the space to be about their occupiers' brands. WeWork, however, took a different strategy where they invested a lot of money in their brand and tried to create something that people wanted to be associated with. So their buildings are very, very heavily branded, and they have an appeal to a certain demographic.
Absolutely. And when you say branded, you're talking WeWork branded rather than the company who's taking the space branded, aren't
yes.
you?
Yeah. WeWork also focused on community and kind of trying to bring the occupiers of the buildings together to actually facilitate a benefit in terms of those interactions between businesses residing in the same building. Whereas historically, that didn't happen. It was more about just having your own office space. And I think the other thing that WeWork did, which has kind of contributed to the enterprise use of flexible workspace, is that they took bigger buildings. So historically, flexible workspaces were around 20,000 square feet, 25,000 square feet. WeWork's biggest building now on the South Bank is 280,000 square feet. And if you imagine, it would take you a very long time to fill a building of that size with entrepreneurs and startups and freelancers. So again, as Toby's talking about this kind of convergence, there's another convergence, which is saying that the operators are taking bigger and bigger spaces. And so they are actively pursuing enterprise clients to fill those spaces, which is along the same lines of what we're also seeing in the same environment, is that there's more and more uncertainty. So occupiers find it harder and harder to plan their resource needs. So all of those ingredients coming together is serving to help drive that growth.
And I think just to pick up on one of your points, maybe around talent, people, community, I mean, the real estate, the occupier industry has definitely shifted in the last few years. And more when we're talking with occupiers, it's about talent attraction, retention. It's about giving workers in the office a reason to go to the office and a reason to stay there and a reason to be more productive there than they would be at home. Do you, and maybe Toby, you can pick up on that. Do you think that this industry is, I mean, I think it's latched onto that in a really good way and is maybe been better at providing some of that community, if that's the right overarching word, to occupiers, which somehow they haven't been able to produce for themselves?
I think it's difficult to say. I think if you go back to one of the core tenets of a flexible workspace provider is that it's flexible. So you live and die by your customers, and your customers are not the companies. They're the people who use the building. They are, it's me or you or Emma. And what is your experience of the space? How happy and productive are you when you come into that building? So to really leverage and ensure that that customer is as happy as they want they can be, and so to ensure that they stay with your building and stay with you as a provider, you have to really work hard at providing for the consumer. So we listen very carefully to our customers. We take very, very clear and direct feedback, and we try and provide things that will make their lives better, and they will the amenities and the service provision that ensures that they want to stay in the building. Because if they want to stay, then the person making the decision has a very easy decision to make. Otherwise, because the contracts are short, they can leave and there's a lot of competition. So we're forced by both the market and by an aspiration to provide the best spaces to really think about how people use space, how it can be as the best space for them to do their best work, but also to live the best possible lives they can. So in our buildings, we have podcast studios because, like you, we recognize that it's a very, very good form of communication for corporate communication to your business, to your staff, or to your customers. We have cinemas, we have gyms, we have healthy food in the meeting rooms, we have cafes, because those things are the things that at a human level people want in their working environment. And if we don't provide them, then our customers can very easily choose other buildings. And so we're constantly working to try and create the best space.
Interesting. I do want to come back to that maybe towards the end when we talk about, you know, what's the next 5 or 10 years look like in terms of this sector. But a couple of other things before we get to that. I'm interested in talking about the landlord side of the business, and in a way why it's taken them, I would suggest, a little bit too long to figure out what they should be doing, because obviously this is competitive to them. But before we do, Emma, can we just maybe wrap up the section on, or talk a little bit more about something you mentioned earlier to do with the number of types of co-working, flexible working spaces there are? Because I know we've talked about this before, and there's women-only ones, there's legal ones. You said there's a very long tail. Clearly, with all the financial disruption, if that's the right way of saying it, at WeWork, there's M&A activity that will presumably happen. Do you see those specialist ones, first of all? I think it's the women's only one, which is a US one, which is recently, it's going to open in Europe. Do you see those specialist ones as having a niche that they can carve out? Or is that something that is the market's too small for?
So you're talking about the Wing, I think, as the female-only operator. I mean, clearly they are growing. They have a footprint of 5 or 6 locations in the US and are expanding into London. Similarly, there's the Albright buildings. They have a couple of locations in London, which are also women-only. And I think if you look at, I touched earlier on the benefit of community, and you know, one of the benefits of being in one of these workspaces is your ability to make meaningful connections with other people in the building. You can argue that both ways, because you can say, well, actually, there's some benefit in being in a building where you've got a variety of industry types and also of individuals that are in that space, because that's where you're going to get the most positive and helpful interactions for your business. However, some people would argue that, you know, particularly if you look at the women's only development, that, you know, clearly the Wing are able to market that on the basis that some female entrepreneurs or female business leaders feel more comfortable in that environment, and there is sufficient demand for them to grow that offer. I think ultimately, if you're appealing to a niche market, your level of growth is going to be curtailed at some point. You're not going to be able to roll that to the entire market. But as we touched on before, the fact there are so many different offers in the market currently, you know, there is still very much potential for this sector to grow. But how do you continue to differentiate so you don't just become a me too and then it becomes a price differentiator? So people are being more and more creative in terms of the offers that they're bringing to the market. And I think some of those will be successful and some of those won't, whether that's because of the proposition or whether there may be other issues around the business model or the building selection or what's going on in the wider environment, remains to be seen.
Yeah, but I guess a lot of it will inevitably be determined by where the market goes, because if there's a downturn in the market, then obviously there's a rental issue, which someone come unstuck around based on how much rent they have to pay the landlord. If we talk about the landlords now for a little bit, because in this whole conversation, as we said, if you like, started by Regus, but it was always someone disrupting an existing industry that, Toby, you described. I guess I was going to say, why is it the landlords have been slow to react to it? But maybe the better question is, what are they doing now? But either or both, Emma, what do you see the landlords now doing? I mean, have they really got this short-term flexible space need, or are they happy to let someone else take that margin from them?
I mean, I think it's really an individual decision. I think it's something that every landlord is thinking about currently. Some of them have taken action already. I think British Land was really the first to market with this in terms of their story proposition, which they've been working on for a couple of years. And it's clear that all of the other major landlords are pursuing different strategies in this space, with Landsec having opened their Mayo building this year, the Crown Estate opening One Heddon Street. We know that GPE are pursuing a number of different options in the market currently. So I think that all of the landlords are just trying to find what is the kind of right solution for them. You know, these are the big ones that are building their own. You've got others that have decided to invest in the market in a different way, with Blackstone investing in the Office Group, Brockton in Fora, Carlyle Group in Uncommon. And, you know, looking at either partnering or buying space, I think it's on everybody's agenda. I think in terms of, you know, why people haven't got into it previously, I think, you know, by its nature, things take a while to kind of move and to change in the property space. You can make a decision, but a project might not deliver for 4 or 5 years time. So yeah. I think a lot of people were initially adopting a kind of watch and see, you know, is this going to be just a fad or is there something that is here to stay? And I think it's clear that, you know, the activity in the space has been going on, as you say, for the last 40 years, but it's really the last 5 to 10 years where this has started to accelerate. And it's got to a level where it is now a key part of our market going forwards. And therefore, it's making everybody stop and think that this is really something that we need to be doing something about.
Okay, so maybe now we can sort of skip to the future, as it were, and wrap up talking a little bit about where we think it's going. Because I think what Emma just said, Toby, is we'd all agree with, which is the market has got to a, if you like, a critical mass, and it is on every occupier's list of things to consider when they're looking at new space. So we're into the much larger spaces being taken by corporates, and sometimes staying for multiple years, but they're buying this flexibility in there, but they're buying this community, and they're buying this different way of getting people to come to the office. You touched on what your group is doing around podcast studios and cinemas. That's a big investment in non-office space services, let's call it. I'm sure you are constantly developing your product type, but where do you see the market going in terms of the offering, without obviously telling us what your top secrets are? Is it going to develop more? Yeah, but is it going to develop more into the attraction of talent, and why do people go to the office? Is that what you're trying to do? I mean, I don't come to the office to use a podcast studio, but you're putting it in, or a cinema for that matter, and some employers might think that's the wrong thing to do. So there's clearly an aim in that.
I think it's what we don't do is put stuff in if we don't think the people who use our buildings want it.
Right.
Because then it really is a complete waste of money and has no value. Where do I think the industry is going, or what are we doing? I think there has got to be a greater connection between the individual, whether you are the most junior on your first day of work joining a business, or you're the CEO. There has to be value in the space that you spend time in and do your business in. And there needs to be a greater connection between that human user level, about what do they want, how do they work, how do they operate, what gives them the best chance to do the best work that they can, be most productive, and what the provider, whether you are a traditional landlord or an operator of the flex in the flex market, provides. So we're not pursuing a specific strategy around trying to create to get people to come to work. What we're trying to do is to create the best space that gives people who come there the best opportunity to be as productive and as happy as they possibly can be. And so we are focusing on certain things. So podcast studios we're doing because communication is a really critical part of the way that a business communicates to its stakeholders. And that can be to its employees, the people who are its customers, its potential recruits, or indeed just generally its peers in the industry. a screening room is about how do you display content. It's not just about, I mean, yes, we do have the sport on or whatever it might be, but actually it's a really good way of providing presentations and best presenting your business's products to customers or indeed to your employees and staff. Healthy people is pretty critical to a successful business. So in our buildings, we have a desire to have every building to have openable windows. Now that's not just a fad, that's about the physiological and psychological benefits of fresh air and the ability to control that. That will enhance the way that people do their work and how they perform on a day rather than necessarily being in an enclosed environment. We have some of those as well. Fitness, we have gyms because if people are fit and healthy, then they are performing better and feel happier and has benefits both physical and mental from a mental health perspective. So really what we're trying to do is just understand people at a very core level and create spaces where they can be both their best people, both professionally and personally. And that sounds, we're not trying to sort of create some sort of lofty ambition. It really is down to the very basics, which are customers who are the clients, being the businesses, have a lot of choice, and they can choose to put their business wherever they want. We create spaces that we think are designed to reflect the neighborhood, the building, and that are different and thoughtfully, you know, cater for the customer base. And then we create the spaces within that that will appeal to the most junior person or the CEO because it will help them be better at what they do. And so I think that that's where we're going. And I think that the rest of the industry is also going in that direction. I don't think we're alone in that. And it's about how you execute it and how do you ensure that you have a business model that recognizes that you make the choice to put in a facility or an amenity that adds value and helps you attract and retain the customer base. If you don't, then it really does become a sort of, almost like the space you've put in just to say you've got it, which really is a sort of, you know, it's a fool's errand in that respect. So when we've made mistakes, right? And we've got super successful ones and we really try and think about it. And if it doesn't work, we change it. Because if we don't listen to our customers, then our customers can leave and go elsewhere.
Yeah, and it's bound to change over time, as you say.
Absolutely. So every building we do, I mean, we opened 6 buildings this year in London, and we've got 2 opening in Germany next year. And yeah, every building we're evolving our offer. And then with our older buildings, we're going back and adapting and changing it, depending on what our customers want. It really, I think the big, it's that B2C, business to consumer understanding that drives our business. And I think that historically in real estate, whichever part of the market you're in, it was business to business. And there was a lack of understanding that the business, i.e. the client or the occupier, really cares about its people. And as a consequence, you've got to understand if you can keep them happy, then you'll keep your business and your clients.
Yeah. And I think a lot of what you've talked to speaks to what you were talking about, Emma, with the different specialty groups, if you will, because that's absolutely about the customer wanting something different and differentiated. I would just to finish up maybe with you, anything to add to what Toby said about where you think the industry is likely to go in terms of the offering? Is it still growing and do you see that growth continuing? And maybe you could talk about that a little bit, and then maybe what you see, what are the new trends that you see happening?
No, absolutely. The industry is still growing. We predict that in central London, which is actually the most mature market for flexible workspace globally, that we'll only be at 5.5% of the total real estate market by the end of 2019.
Which is tiny.
It's still we probably get about 50% of the headlines in the property press, yeah, but it's about 5% of the total marketplace. So for me, there is still plenty of room for growth. There's all sorts of statistics quoted about how big this is going to be, but I don't think anybody really knows. You know, it's easy to imagine that we could get to 10 to 15% of the total market, which is still a doubling or tripling of where we're at now. And that's exactly for all of the reasons that Toby just talked about, that the trends that Toby said is something that's impacting the whole real estate market, and that it is all about the level of service that you're operating and engaging with every user of the building, not just the person who's signing the lease. I think if you look kind of more broadly at the sector, it feels like, you know, we've kind of gone through one cycle or one evolution. It feels like there's more change still to come in terms of, you know, there are some operators that are experiencing some bumps in the road currently, and we don't know what impact that is going to have on the wider sector. If there is a downturn, you know, it's likely that there would be some further consolidation, and with that long tail of operators, you'd think that that's likely. You know, there's always been acquisition and consolidation in the sector, but we think that that might accelerate. And you know, we don't know exactly what this is going to look like in 10 years' time, but I think we can say, you know, the sector will be a firm part of our industry. It's likely to be a bigger percentage of the market than it is today. We don't know quite how big that is likely to be, but really what everybody is doing is responding to those core occupier needs that we've talked about throughout this discussion in terms of flexibility, service, competition, and for talent and so on. And as long as the market is helping occupiers do that, there's no reason why it won't continue to grow.
Interesting. Guys, both Toby and Emma, thank you for coming into the studio and sharing your thoughts. It's been fun having you here. Maybe we'll do it again in 6 months or 12 months and see where things are then. Thank you.
Thank you.